Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to CenterPoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. In this show, we will discuss ways that we can journey to our own centers. This can help us access our inner resources to improve our physical abilities and health, our mental strength, our emotional well-being, and our spirituality. And I'm so excited to introduce you today to our special guest, my good friend, Dr. Amir Raz. Hello, Amir.
Hello.
Let me tell the audience a little bit about you. I'm quite honored to be able to interview you. Dr. Raz is a world-renowned expert in the science of suggestion, and he has recent positions as the Canada Research Chair, Professor of Psychiatry, Neurology, and Neurosurgery, and Psychology at McGill University, and he was the founding director of the Institute for Interdisciplinary Brain and Behavioral Sciences at Chapman University. And his work has been covered widely in the media, and he's written over 200 peer-reviewed articles about his work. And he has an upcoming book, The Suggestible Brain, that we'll focus most of our conversations about. But I was hoping, Amir, that you could start explaining how you got to this kind of position. I know you were a magician earlier on in life. And how do you even get into magic? What happened? What's your story?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on your podcast. It's great to be able to speak to you about the book and about my work, and I appreciate the opportunity. I started out as a teenager, just having a cursory interest in magic, just like many kids do, vanishing this object and that object, and doing some card tricks and some coin tricks and some handkerchief stuff, and didn't really think much of it. Went to the public library, read the books, did what most kids do, maybe a little bit more. But slowly, I got more and more into it, and surprisingly, I found myself at a fairly young age joining magic circles and interacting with magicians, and the world of magic became sort of a big component of my life. I mean, I was doing other things. I was playing the trumpet. I was into music. I was doing all kinds of other things, but magic was always a component there, and I would like to say today, and you know, in hindsight, in retrospect, that many of my career choices and many of the things that I decided to research as a full-fledged researcher after several academic degrees and so on was largely shaped or somewhat shaped by my early experiences with magic, with the magical art, because I think that there's a lot that happens in that world, in that sort of secret coterie of professionals who are dealing with all kinds of secret techniques that they don't really share for manipulating perception and sensation, that is very relevant for psychological science, and later, when I became a neuroscientist, also for brain science.
Fascinating. You know, when I talk to youngsters, I tell them, develop a wide range of interests, because you never know how they'll play in your later career. So you demonstrated that really well.
Definitely. I mean, I never thought, when I was younger, I never thought that magic would play such an important integral part in the kind of work that I did as an adult scientist.
So what made you switch? Why did you had, I think, a very successful magician career. Why did you switch to neuroscience?
I think that I never thought of magic as a career of sorts. To me, magic was an avocation in the sense that I enjoyed it, and I made some money on the side, and I was able to perform, and I felt comfortable being on the stage and so on. And it would get me the kind of attention that was helpful to have at that particular stage of my career, but it was very clear to me from a fairly young age that I wanted to get into academics, and I wanted to know, learn more about psychology and about human behavior. It was just an interesting lab. It was an interesting informal playground where I could experiment, and I could do all kinds of informal interactions with the audience, with people, to see how they think, to see how you can get people to follow certain instructions or certain directions, to see the power of suggestion and so on. And I also specialized in a particular kind of magic that is called mentalism. Mentalism is the kind of magic that magicians, who are really sort of actors who are playing the role of wizards to some extent, you know, for the entertainment of the audiences. I was focusing on mentalism, which is sort of the theatrical act of mind reading. And there is a lot to be said about how people can use the techniques of mentalism when it comes to the science of suggestion. At the time, I knew very little about the science. With time, I learned a great deal about the science, and I basically used a lot of my previous experience on stage and a lot of the knowledge that I had from the magical arts in order to create scientific experiments, lab experiments that were you know, with the result of which I was able to, you know, basically get some insights, some important insights into human behavior.
So you speak of the mentalism as a magic act. I'm using the wrong word. Are there people, do you think, who use mentalism approaches, let's say, in their psychological care of patients, and they think they read their patient's mind, but the same kind of approach that they pick up cues they may not be even aware of that helps them better understand how the patient's thinking?
Well, I think that to a large extent, medicine, clinical interactions have a human component, a psychological component to them that is often relegated to terms like bedside manners or placebo effect or nonspecific effect that is largely unexplored or not sufficiently explored. What I very quickly recognized, when I say very quickly, it's a mischaracterization. It took me many years and decades to explore these things in depth. But the idea that you can actually influence people and you can actually shape and mold physiology with suggestion is an idea that I did not invent. What I noticed was that most of the research into these fields was in a fairly nascent stage. It was very embryonic. Most of the studies that were done were fairly crude. The paradigms were not very solid. The experimental design was not very strong and robust. And as a result, the scientists, the people in the academic community that sort of looked over these studies, I wouldn't say dismissed them, but largely poo-pooed them as not very serious. And they had, you know, the right to do so because the experiments themselves were not extremely rigorous. On the other hand, it's sometimes difficult to conduct these experiments. So what I did from a very early part of my career is I took some effects that I knew a great deal about scientifically, and I started introducing non-specific elements to them. I started introducing all kinds of, if you want to call it bedside manners, or if you want to call it extra pharmacological elements to them, that would basically demonstrate how we can tease apart some elements that have to do with suggestion or with, if you want to call it mentalism or whatever, so that we can actually tease apart the effects of what we know are coming from measures that we know how to measure in the lab from other things, be it, you know, whatever you want to call it, that are coming from a different thing. By doing this kind of studies very meticulously and very diligently over many, many experiments with different control groups and in different labs and with different researchers and by having converging information over many, many, many experiments, I was able slowly to nibble at this notion that these things are immaterial. I was able to demonstrate that a lot, under the umbrella of suggestion, there's a lot of parameters that can actually shape, sometimes no less than parameters that come from pharmacological agents, sometimes no less than, you know, things that come from other interventions, are physiology. And that, to me, is the science of suggestion.
And were you surprised about what you found, or you sort of expected, but then finally showed it? How did it work for you?
some of the stuff that I found was definitely surprising for me. I sort of suspected or I hypothesized the general direction, but I think I never fully realized how far it can go. I never expected, for example, I always expected that suggestion, be it hypnotic suggestion or a different form of suggestion, would have an effect on people or on certain people more than others, I guess people who are more suggestible, but I never expected that I would, with suggestion, I would be able to obliterate completely or eliminate completely processes that the literature claims are completely robust and ballistic. If you told me when I started doing my research that with suggestion you can create, even temporarily, a situation in the brain of a person that they won't be able to read, I think that that to me would sound a little bit much. When I did the experiment and when I chose the people very carefully and I did them under very, you know, strict controlled conditions in a lab, I was able to demonstrate that I can actually turn off the reading areas, or some of the reading areas in the brains of people who are proficient readers. So that to me was a sensational surprise. Did I expect that they would read, you know, less efficiently, less effectively? Yes, but I didn't really expect, for example, in this case, that they would turn into complete alexics.
You know, I know some of your career, and we could talk for hours, but let's focus on the book that's soon to be published, The Suggestible Brain. Tell us, you know, why did you decide to write the book?
So, one of the things that happens as you get older is that you come to some overarching realizations about what is your contribution to the field, what is your contribution maybe to the world, to the community. And I noticed that over time, I am writing many scientific papers. I write them and I publish them. That's what academics do. They read, they write, they do experiments, they write up their results. And I noticed that although I publish my papers in very, you know, high-flying or very prominent scientific journals, most of the people don't read them. They actually read the New York Times version of it or the Scientific American blurb about it or something like that. And I actually learned it, the hard way. I would go to conferences and, at a conference, a colleague would come to me, like a fellow scientist, and they would say, oh, you know, congratulations. I saw that you just had another paper published on such and such. I really liked it. But through the conversation, I would see that they actually didn't read the paper. They read, let's say, the Scientific American version of the paper. And how did I know? Because Scientific American got something a little wrong. I mean, the person who interviewed me over the phone in Scientific American just spoke to me for 15 minutes. When they wrote their article in Scientific American, they got like a little detail wrong. They didn't do it intentionally or maliciously. It just so happened. And when the guy speaks to me, when the fellow scientist speaks to me at the conference, I see that they actually didn't read the original, the source paper. They read the Scientific American version of the paper for the masses. So when it happened, when this became sort of a common occurrence, when I saw that actually even my fellow scientists don't read the scientific papers so very carefully or not at all, I realized that perhaps I would do a lot better if I would just take my, you know, the information that I know and the findings that I know about and make it available, make it accessible to the lay public, to the general intellectual reader. And that's what I tried to do. Now, I've written something like, I can't even remember if it's 5, 6, or 7, but I've written a few academic books with publishers like Oxford University Press or, you know, academic press and stuff. And these are, again, books that cater to a very specific audience, to an academic audience. This is the first book, The Suggestible Brain. This is the first book that I wrote with the lay reader, the intellectual general reader in mind. And for that, you don't need a degree, and you don't need any special background. You just need to be interested, and you need to be able, you know, to know how to read. And I think that there's millions of people out there who can connect with these themes and understand how many of the things that we find in the lab and many of the new information that comes from brain science and from psychological science about suggestion and what suggestion can do has a tremendous tremendous benefit, not just to people who are sick and suffer from illnesses and if it's mental illness, if it's, you know, a functional illness, but also to completely, you know, healthy, normal, if you want to call it, although I don't like to use this word, but healthy people who are ignoring or largely unaware of the power of suggestion, not just when it comes to a voting year or voting behavior, but when it comes to anything from, you know, visual acuity to losing weight to controlling pain. And that really is the contribution that I'm making with this book, The Suggestible Brain. I'm basically talking about how you can use suggestion in your daily common life.
Fascinating. So, you know, you and I have talked a lot about books, and because we've paralleled, I've also written a book, as you know, to the lay public, wanting to get a message across. So if what's your elevator pitch? What you want? So you want people to know that their brain is suggestible. What is it supposed to do with that information? What would you like to see them do?
My elevator pitch is that most people think of suggestibility as a liability. They think that to be suggestible means to be invincible, spineless, feeble-minded, and lots of other superlatives that are largely negative. And that's actually the opposite. People who are suggestible, and everybody is suggestible to some extent, people who are suggestible actually have a gift. It's an evolutionary gift. Being suggestible is being adaptable. It's a learning mechanism. It's basically a trick, one of the cognitive tricks that humans have in order to be able to navigate a very complicated world that is changing very rapidly, both through culture and technology. A lot more rapidly through culture and technology than through genetics, for example. And suggestion is one of the few tricks that are largely unexplored in the human psyche, to the sense, or in the sense that many of the things that influence our behavior actually come from variations on suggestion. This can be done clinically in the medical realm, in medical spheres, when we're being treated, if it's for depression, if it's for pain, if it's for other things, smoke cessation, and so on and so forth, mental illness. And it could also be about career choices, about, you know, when it comes to our relationships with our family members, with our friends. Suggestion is a very powerful tool in basically not just negotiating the world, but negotiating ourselves and how we create narratives and how we construe the way that we think about things. And the power of suggestion is something that has been used in our society mostly in order to market things to us, in order for us to buy things, or in order for us to do certain things that we don't want to do, in the sense of mind control. And most people have learned this phrase, power of suggestion, in the wrong context, in a nefarious, negative context. But the power of suggestion is actually a gift where you can harness and leverage the power of suggestion in order to create your own reality, if you wanted one, that is a lot more enticing, a lot more real than reality itself. And in a world that we live today, the world that we live in today, which is a post-truth world, where people don't even know what the information that they're getting, if it's on the web, if it's through social media, they don't even know what's true and what's not true anymore. The whole notion of suggestibility and the power of suggestion becomes all the more relevant, because we are beginning to realize, and that's where the magic part comes into it, we're beginning to realize that some of the illusions that we see are so good, they feel so real, that it's difficult for us to tell if some of the stuff that we are witnessing, some of the stuff that we're consuming, is real or it's an illusion. And this is even before we go into AI, artificial intelligence. This is even before we go into deep fakes and into things like that. Just suggestion, as the notion of information that is communicated to individuals, and what does it do? Depending on the source of the information, depending on the timing of the information, depending on how receptive you are to this information. These are critical parameters that shape many of our thoughts, emotions, and actions. And this cognitive component of the power of suggestion is what I explore in the book, and how people can take with them in order to improve their lives.
You know, I think it's fascinating that you explained that suggestibility is a helpful evolutionary step forward. People are suggestible, can adapt more easily. And yet, as I'm listening to you, evolution is, of course, a process of millions and hundreds of thousands of years. And in the last 5,000 years of written history, and even the last 20 years of social media, how humans are affected by suggestions has really changed dramatically. So how do you incorporate what we are bombarded with today in terms of having humans respond to it in a system that was set up hundreds of thousands of years ago?
Well, suggestion, from an evolutionary standpoint, is help. It's a mechanism that helps individuals learn without going to school, and without necessarily reading a book, and without necessarily being in a situation where they're asking for the knowledge. A conversation around the bonfire, a tip from a parent, a slight comment from a doctor, a spouse who makes a quick remark about something. These are all suggestions, and they can be extremely powerful, sometimes more powerful than any book that you would read or any lecture that you would listen to, depending on the individual, depending on the context. In my book, I basically not just look at what suggestions are, but how they can be catered and how can they can be tailored to individuals for maximum leverage.
Well, when we come back, we're going to drill more. I'd love to hear some specific examples of how we can use suggestions to help ourselves. We'll be right back after these messages. This is CenterPoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.
Coming attraction, Life Guide for Teens, Harnessing Your Inner Power to Be Healthy, Happy, and Confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Anbar to be published early 2025. Dr. Anbar's renowned counseling practice, CenterPoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Anbar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Anbar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit dranbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Anbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At CenterPoint Medicine, with services in La Jolla, California, and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at CenterPointMedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Audiobooks gives you instant access to over 50,000 of the bestsellers and hottest book titles in romance, mystery, fiction, and many other genres. Just visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on Audiobooks to get started.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
More exhilarating talk. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to CenterPoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. Our very special guest is my good friend, Dr. Amir Raz, who's telling us about the power of suggestion that he discusses in his forthcoming book, The Suggestible Brain. Who is the publisher going to be?
Hachette is the publisher. It's one of the big six.
Excellent. Congratulations on that. So,
thank you.
Let's drill on some specific application of suggestion. You mentioned earlier that suggestion can be used to treat depression and anxiety. How does that work?
Today, depression and anxiety are largely treated by a combination of polypharmacy. Most psychiatrists have a fairly large array of medications available to them, from antidepressants to antipsychotics, from stimulants to mood stabilizers. But the most important thing is that these are largely biological interventions. We have a particular theory that doesn't always hold water about what happens from a neuroscience standpoint, from a neurological standpoint, about the synaptic cleft and about certain neurotransmitters that are being released in a particular neurochemical fashion. And I don't want to get into it, but, you know, these theories sometimes are challenged. But whether they're challenged or not is irrelevant. We can look at numbers, and we can look how effective these drugs are. And the fact is that, for example, when it comes to antidepressants for depression, they're largely ineffective in the sense that although there's statistical significance there when we do the experiments, there's not a whole lot of clinical significance. And again, in my book, I sort of explain the difference between what is statistical significance, what is clinical significance. But it is a short bottom line. Clinical significance is what is the practical value in real life. So when we look at, for example, antidepressant medication for depression, let's say, and we have to be very specific and careful about these things, it's quite clear that the effects there are very modest at best, and they're not as strong as we initially thought that they were. So much so that sometimes when we do a comparison to a placebo, in other words, a substance that is inactive, we basically see that they're comparable clinically. They might not be comparable statistically, but they're comparable clinically in terms of what the outcome is for the patient. With these kind of data as a background, we need to think about what is more effective. And one of the things that we see in depression and anxiety, all kinds of situations that millions and millions of people are suffering from and in a big way, we see that, you know, there's no social component. There's no component of hope. There's no component of, I would say, psychological optimism that is integrated into these treatments. Because by giving somebody a medication, an antidepressant or otherwise for that matter, does not take care of social circles, of friendships, of getting out there, of socializing, of being in touch with other humans and so on. A lot of what suggestion does, a lot of what we can do with suggestion is change the way that people construe their own narratives. We can change the way people in a top-down fashion as opposed to in a bottom-up. So the medications work in bottom-up fashion. But when we are giving someone a suggestion, the suggestion starts with how we think. It changes our expectations. It changes the way we view the situation. And as a result, it can also instill things like hope. It can also instill things like motivation, reason to change our behavior that is not coming through a bottom-up process that has to do with what's happening at the synapse at a very low level in the cascade of events, but it comes from something that happens higher up at our higher brain function level and then trickles down to meet somewhere with the effect of a bottom-up process that would maybe be triggered by the medication or not even by a medication but by something else. The reason that I say that this is important, it's almost like the difference between imagining a big lemon that is being cut in half and then squeezed above your head so that it falls and drips into your tongue. For some people, just imagining this is enough in order to get saliva going, in order to feel the acidity on, you know, on the tongue. That would be a top-down process because nothing is really happening. It's all in your mind. It's just a narrative. It's just an imagination of something that is happening. But it causes a physiological response versus if you actually do it, if you take a lemon and you cut it and you squeeze the lemon and you put it on your tongue and then you get this flavor, that would be much stronger and that would be sort of a bottom-up process. What I'm trying to say is sometimes the top-down process, just imagining something, can be very strong, sometimes even stronger than the bottom-up process. One example is, for example, the fact that we can take imaginary pills. In other words, if people go through the process of imagining that they're taking a pill, we can see sometimes improvements in their condition. These are things that just blow the mind. But it has been documented very well over the, you know, past decades. It started, you know, several decades ago with some people from Scandinavia who basically were brave enough to just make a study out of it. You know, take imaginary pills. I mean, who would even think about doing a study with imaginary pills? But when we do this and when we do later experiments with placebos, when they're open placebos, in other words, you know that you're taking a placebo. I'm giving you a placebo and I'm taking it. This is a placebo, but there's reason to think that this is going to help you, and I show you the literature. People do get better, and they get better for irritable bowel syndrome and for lower back pain, and yes, also for depression. The reason that this is important to explain or this is important to dwell on is because the human mind is very complex, and not everything in the human mind is happening in a bottom-up fashion. Many things happen to us based on top-down processes. and those involved, not just socialization and hope, but also motivation and optimism and outlook.
So if you're looking at a patient who has depression, and the patient says, I'm never going to get better, the world is a dark place, I'm lost, what kind of suggestion can you give that would help them process differently top down?
Well, first of all, just to clarify, I'm a researcher, so I don't, you know, necessarily take people as a clinician and do these, you know, treatments with them. Having said that, what I do recommend that people will do is I would recommend that, you know, they would exercise, and I would recommend that they do psychotherapy. If it's cognitive behavioral therapy or something else, I would recommend that they engage in social groups and that they go out and interact with people. I would recommend that they do a whole slew of other things. If it's meditation, if it's yoga, if it's other things that I recommend in my book and so on and so forth, before they go, for example, and take antidepressants that come not just at a price, but also at the cost of side effects. Sometimes strong side effects and debilitating side effects, and not to mention difficulty in weaning off some of these drugs. So I have no reason to question the fact that, you know, for some people antidepressants are effective, and I suggest that if some people are taking antidepressants and they're happy with them for their depression, it's working well. I'm not saying that they should change course. I'm just saying that there's a whole bunch of other things that people can do that are less toxic and potentially on par, if not better, before they go in that direction. Suggestion is one of them. And the power of suggestion, and again, this is a little bit, I mean, when I say the power of suggestion, it could come through meditation, it could come through guided imagery, it could come through psychotherapy, it could a situation where a clinician or a friend or a trusted source is talking to the patient and just helping the patient come up with a narrative that is quite different from the narrative that they currently harbor that would instill and promote a lot more optimism, a lot more, I would say, of a global trajectory that changes the narrative in a beneficial way.
So in that kind of scenario, perhaps part of the suggestion to say exercise and sleep and good diet will help you improve. That's the suggestion.
Absolutely.
Right there.
Absolutely. That's a tremendous suggestion. If people could just follow it, the world would be a better place.
Fascinating. Well, we'll be right back. We'll explore some more about the science of suggestion with Dr. Amir Raz. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.
Make-A-Wish has been granting life-changing wishes for children and families for over 40 years. A wish is something that gives children the opportunity to look outside their illness and restore a sense of childhood back to the child. With the help of donors and more than 43,000 worldwide volunteers, Make-A-Wish has collectively granted more than 520,000 wishes worldwide. Dr. Anbar has referred many patients to Make-A-Wish. To make a donation, go to worldwish.org. That's worldwish.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Anbar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit DrAnbar.com.
Reach your health and fitness goals. Whether you want to lose weight, learn to dance, build muscle, or just live healthy, Beachbody gives you unlimited access to the nation's most popular fitness and weight loss solutions. Visit our advertiser page and click on Beachbody now.
Dr. Ron Anbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Coming attraction, life guide for teens harnessing your inner power to be healthy, happy, and confident. a new book by Dr. Ron Ambar to be published early 2025. Dr. Ambar's renowned counseling practice, Centerpoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Ambar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
All positive talk with a mature edge. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Ambar. Special guest, Dr. Amir Raz, the world-famous neuroscientist and author of The Suggestible Brain. We're picking Dr. Raz's brain about suggestion. You said earlier that people sometimes, because of power of suggestion, can't tell reality from illusion. Can you elaborate on that, and how do you get out of that kind of mindset?
Well, I mean, sometimes it's actually quite benign. For example, I have a friend who's extremely lactose intolerant. She's been lactose intolerant for many years, as a matter of fact, since I've known her. And for some reason, one day when we were walking on a boardwalk next to the ocean, there was a gelato vendor with a gelato cart, and she said to me, you know, hey, would you like some gelato? And I said, well, I thought you're lactose intolerant. No, she said, oh yeah, but gelato doesn't have any lactose. I said, no. She said, no, absolutely not. This is gelato. It's not the ice cream. I said, okay, well, if it does it, I mean, if you want to have some, sure, I'll have some. I'm a big fan of frozen desserts, and yeah, gelato would suit me just fine. So we had very healthy portions. I actually treated her to it. And I was amazed that she could have like a whole gelato, a big generous portion of it, with no problem whatsoever, because in her mind, gelato does not contain any lactose. I mean, I know that gelato contains lactose, not because I know it. I actually went back to the vendor and I asked him later, you know, does it have, I said, sure, it's made from milk. So just a different way of preparation. It's a different kind of fat. It's a different kind. So it's gelato, but it still has lactose. But in her mind, although she's lactose intolerant, and this has been certified, or this has been verified by biological tests, like a stool test, like, you know, a breast test and so on, and she is. But in this particular case, it's very clear to her that gelato doesn't have lactose, and she's sort of either cheating herself or thinking very strongly that she shouldn't have a response or whatever, and she doesn't. Now, is it possible that she's having some responses, but she dismisses it as something else? Yeah, it's possible. But the fact is that she can have a whole generous portion of gelato and not feel discomfort from the gelato, or at least not enough so that it would come to her as related to her lactose intolerance. This is not necessarily an example of illusion versus reality. It's just a good example of how your narrative changes the way you construct and construe the reality that you experience. I'm not saying that she's delusional, and I didn't want to disabuse her of her notion, but it's just one example of how these things work in the real world. Another example is, for example, I had when I was in my training at a hospital doing rotations in a psychiatry department. I had once experience of meeting a young woman, a relatively young woman, who was under the impression that she was pregnant, although she wasn't. Her narrative, the story that she had in her head, was that she was completely pregnant, and the fact that all these pregnancy tests came back negative was irrelevant to her. She said, I know that I'm pregnant, I can feel it. And as a result of her feeling pregnant, she had a bit of a distended belly. She had all kinds of changes that were beginning to occur in her body and so on. And this was not necessarily because she was deranged. It's not necessarily, but it was a situation where the narrative was so strong with her, and she was her personal life, her personal situation was such that she was so hoping to be pregnant that it sort of takes over. And I'm not saying that with suggestion you could grow hair on a bald head, on a glabrous scalp. I'm not saying that with suggestion you can grow a supernumerary arm, like a third hand or a third arm or something. But I am suggesting that with suggestion you can bring about certain changes in thresholds of pain and certain changes in physiological processing, certain changes in the processing of information. And when we get, as we get, more and more of a scientific handle on how far we can go with this and who are the people that this is likely to work for better than others, because some people are more suggestible than others, and more, some people are a lot more suggestible in some forms of suggestion. Suggestion is not a monolithic thing. There's a hypnotic suggestion and there's imaginary suggestion. There's all kinds of, when you get into this field, you can parse it in different ways. Once we know the suggestibility profile of an individual, we can actually tailor treatments that are suggestion-based that are sometimes no less effective, sometimes more effective than some of the pharmacological treatments that we offer people. And this is the really the message of the book, that, you know, that there's quite a bit out there that is not necessarily just medical in the sense of taking a drug. There's no question that those drugs are important, effective, and changed our humanity. But it's also important to understand that, you know, the whole top-down effect of suggestion is yet to be explored and is probably as powerful, if not more so.
If you suspect that you yourself have a belief that's maybe an illusion, or your loved one has a belief that is an illusion, how do you break through that? Or if it's a beneficial illusion, like the gelato example, no need to do anything about it, but suppose it's a destructive illusion. How do you respond to somebody you think has that, or if you suspect you yourself have that?
These are very difficult questions to answer. They draw on morality and ethics. They draw also on some form of it's contentious. I mean, we're getting into the twilight zone of you know what's ethical to do and how to go about it. I have been in several situations in my life where it was very clear to me that some of the people that I encountered had all kinds of weird beliefs or beliefs that were not particularly true. But I chose not to disabuse them of their beliefs because I realized that, you know, doing so might be detrimental to their health, or what would probably put them in a more difficult situation. I was also in situations where I did the opposite, and I chose to disabuse them of their false beliefs or false notions. I think that it's very difficult to come up with some generalities here. I think it's super specific to the situation and to the context that we're dealing with. I think also that this field is very young, and many of the things that we encounter here are relatively new, and we don't have quite the right grasp on how to deal with this in sort of a comprehensive way. Just as a quick example to show how tricky this is, when I started doing hypnosis research at Cornell Medical School in New York City, I did most of my studies on medical students there. And Cornell medical students are probably some of the top medical students in the country. It's a very competitive medical school to get into, and I'd like to think that some of the medical students there are some of the top in the nation. Up, they would come into the study and say, "Oh, I'm just doing it for the money. You don't have to, you don't expect anything." And they actually were the best hypnotic subjects I've ever met. Some of them in my life, they would do crazy things during the hypnotic session, and later I would have to show, everything was videotaped. Later, I would show them the videotape, and they would be shocked at what they did. And over time, I decided not to show them the videos and send them their merry way, thinking that they did nothing during the hypnotic session, because I saw that some of them got very distraught seeing the video of how they performed during the session. So these are calls that you sometimes make, and they're in a way arbitrary.
You know, working with teenagers, I often deal with kids who have a strong belief that's an illusion, but sometimes it's very difficult to give them feedback that they can accept, especially if the belief gets in their way and leads to, for example, dangerous behavior. So I look forward
very
to following
so.
Your research and see if there's a way of helping people with illusionary beliefs change them in time. Well, we'll be right back after these messages. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Unbar.
More than 30,000 children and adults of every race and ethnic group in the U.S. have cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is a disease causing long-lasting lung infections, limiting the ability to breathe over time. Dr. Anbar participated in research that helped advance survival of cystic fibrosis patients by more than 20 years. He encourages you to donate to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation to help find a cure. It's easy to donate. Go to cff.org. That's cff.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
Constant Contact and your small business make a perfect fit for marketing. They give you what you need to succeed. Fast and easy email marketing at your fingertips. Visit the HealthyLife.net advertiser page and click on Constant Contact to start your marketing.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Ambar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit dranbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Ambar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Radio your way. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Unbar. Our special guest is my friend, Dr. Amir Raz, author of The Suggestible Brain. Amir, you've had an amazing career, and you're still in the middle of it, I hope. And I'm wondering, based on your knowledge and wisdom and experience, in this segment we often talk about tips people can take home and start applying today. What three tips would you give our audience that they can start doing to improve their lives based on your work with suggestion and neuroscience?
Well, that's a good question because takeaways is something that people are always interested in. In my book, The Suggestible Brain, I try to give takeaways for just about every dimension that I talk about. So when I talk about, for example, suggestion in the workplace, or if I talk about suggestion for depression or things of that nature, I try to give like very specific examples of how you can use suggestions for these things. But what I wanted to maybe do here, because we are talking to a very large listening audience here, the most important thing that people should know is that suggestion works on people whether they're suggestible or not. When I did my first studies, when I did my very early studies around year 2000 at Cornell, I discovered that people who were highly suggestible could do really phenomenal things. They could, as I mentioned before, stop reading. They could, forget certain words. They could not process certain things. It was really shocking to me what they could do. And for a few years, I was so enamored of these highly suggestible people that I sort of neglected the group of people who were not highly suggestible. And it took me a few years to get back to the data and look very carefully under a very strong magnifying glass, so to speak, under the people who were not very suggestible, and I saw that even people who are not very suggestible were affected. They were just not affected to the same extent, but they too were affected. They too were moved, and we could see the physiological changes there as well. And then what I started doing is I started running very nuanced comparisons between people who are highly suggestible, people who are less suggestible. And this is determined, by the way, through fairly strong psychometrics, which is the science of psychological tests. We can determine whether a person is highly suggestible or not highly suggestible in the same way that we can determine, you know, what is the IQ of a certain person. As a matter of fact, the psychometrics of suggestibility is even stronger than the psychometrics of IQ tests. But the fact of the matter is that even people who are not suggestible and don't fall into the rubric or under the category of people who are moved by suggestion are still moved by suggestions in a particular context. And this is measurable not just by brain scans, but also by reaction time and speed and accuracy and things of that nature. We could demonstrate, for example, that people who are, let's say, role enacting, people who are, let's say, are taught or being given the theatrical role of pilots or cadets, you know, in aircrew kind of situation, are able to see a little bit better when you do eye tests on them. And that's because you sort of impress upon them that they're pilots, and pilots see really well. And as a result of this, you can see when you do a visual acuity test that they're actually a little bit better in their visual acuity. Now, this is not a result of changes in their eye. It's a result of changes in the way that their brain processes blurry information. And this is something that is very important to understand. With suggestion, we can make the way that people process information different. We can make it better if we give them a suggestion that is empowering. Hopefully that's the direction, because you can also take it in a nefarious, in a negative direction, and, you know, get with suggestions, you can get people into the world, into the negative, you know, dark domain of gaslighting and mental abuse. And we don't want that, God forbid. But, you know, this is an election year. This is 2024, and we're coming on very important elections in November, and the whole world is going through many elections, from India to the European Union. And this is another place where suggestion becomes extremely powerful, and that is how can, with suggestion, we can influence the voting behavior of individuals. And in my book, I describe very well how you can protect yourself sometimes from the onslaught of information that is really meant to influence your voting behavior. Now, it's not something that you can summarize in a sentence, but you should be aware that you're vulnerable to suggestion. Suggestions are extremely powerful, particularly when you are vulnerable as a result of something that happens in your life. So people are more susceptible, for example, to love advice after a divorce. People are more susceptible to career advice before they take their first job or before they go into a conversation with their employer about a raise, and so on and so forth. There are certain junctures in our lives when we are more susceptible to suggestion. When we're depressed, we are more susceptible to certain suggestions. We're more susceptible to certain dark information because we're already in a dark place, and it's very easy to, you know, bring us deeper into that hole with some dark suggestions and so on. It's important to realize these things. People are more susceptible to political suggestions that sort of enforce their party line, no matter what that party line is, than to listen to facts or verified information that goes against it. That's why echo chambers are so powerful for people. That's why people find themselves magnetically attracted to people who are basically saying what they believe in and then looping them or you know, wiring them even further into existing party lines and pre-existing notions.
The one thing is you want to be aware that we're all suggestible to some degree. And actually, one of the things you said about imagining you're a pilot, I teach my teenage athletes to imagine they're a famous athlete and they improve their performance by imagining.
Absolutely. I mean, imagination is a very, very important tool, a very powerful tool, and one that is largely absent from modern medicine. It's very rare to go to medical school and find courses or instruction or I would say even open discussions about not just suggestions and motivation, not just imagination and bedside manners, but even about placebo effect or about the psychological factors that go into lactose intolerance or asthma or other things. It's extremely important to understand that, for example, when it comes to asthma, and I know that you have, you know, specifically a background in pulmonary medicine, today, to determine asthma in sort of a scientific, rigorous way, we give some kind of an airway irritant that usually comes in some kind of, you know, five gradation. So, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 with increasing irritability to the airways in order to see, you know, when we get a sort of an asthma attack from a baseline. And in experiments that I did, when I replaced the first two doses, so the dose number one and number two, instead of being airway irritants that are going up and increasing irritability, I basically put placebos there. It was still working just as effectively. So when people with asthma came and they thought that they were ingesting an irritant, they usually had a full-blown asthma attack within the first or second placebo doses, just because they were expecting to get it, just because they were expecting to get an irritant. And there's a lot of research showing that even biological things, such as asthma, such as lactose intolerance, such as irritable bowel syndrome, such as many of the things that we often classify as functional, because we don't quite have a good grasp on the physiology or on the anatomy that is involved in great detail, we can show that some of these top-down interventions, be it suggestion, motivation, imagination, and so on, are extremely effective in those contexts and for those individuals with a great boon to their health.
Wonderful. So another lesson then is be aware that if you have these symptoms, if you have chronic illness, that suggestion can help improve your symptoms in ways that you might not even find believable, but they do, and there's a lot of evidence that this does work. Amir, thank you so much for educating us. Again, the Suggestible Brain is a great resource. I encourage all of you to pre-order, and it'll be out soon. And maybe you'll come back and teach us some more another day. Again, thank you so much, Amir.
Thank you so much. The book is going to come out only in November, with probably pre-ordering would be the 3 months leading to it. But I am very happy to make some early drafts of the first chapter of selected parts of the book available to your listeners, and I'd be very happy to talk about it again.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.